Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's September 4th, 2021, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or you can find me at overthecap.com. Nelly the Bunny is here with me. She is back after a little bit of time at family friend's house while we were away on vacation. Nelly, you have anything now that you've returned? Still nothing, but I'm sure she'll make some noise during the podcast, as usual. So, yeah, so this is the first podcast in 2 weeks. Glad to be back. Hopefully you will stick with me and you made it back to this. So thank you very much if you were doing that. I was away at Disney for quite a while. This was probably the longest vacation I took in, man, some time, maybe ever. Went there for a little while. I posted a couple pictures on Twitter, got some feedback on that about, I think the main one was about dad shoes, and the second one was pretty much needing to update my profile picture. And I guess some people were a little surprised that I'm somewhat in shape. Not like good shape, but somewhat in shape. I think that was the other takeaway from posting a couple of pictures at from Epcot, I guess, on the timeline. Or maybe just one picture. I don't even remember how many we put up. And I think there was one comment about not drinking beers while there. So there was a logic in my trip, I guess. So if you've never been to Epcot, Epcot's a lot of fun. They have a lot of different drinks that you can do. It's expensive. That's the negative of Disney. But, you know, you can do the drinks around the world kind of stuff. So one night I decided to do mixed drinks. Another night I decided to do beer. I was going to do a third night with wine and then kind of backed off on that and just did another night with just doing a couple beers here and there while they had a little band playing. It was a 80s tribute band that was kind of fun. My daughter liked it. So that was cool. The dad shoes were in full effect, and those will remain there the next time we go to Disney, which might not be for another 2 years, but they're comfortable to walk in, and you definitely need that when you're there. But glad to be back. You know, we got through our final cutdowns. It was a lot of work to get through that. I think we have OTC pretty much in order through Thursday. Hopefully by the time you listen to this, I'll catch up on Friday and Saturday's transactions. I've just kind of been working through some other stuff on the back end and just trying to do a couple updates to the site. You'll notice some more pictures, I think, pop up on the player profile pages. And I know Nick's working on some stuff that he'll pump out this year. I think in regards to kind of updating the calculator, and we've got some new stuff, I think, on the premium end that we'll get out there. And when the regular season starts, it might not be for week one, but definitely by week two, we'll get the player valuations and all that kind of stuff out there each week. I'll just have to figure out how we're going to work that in with my schedule this year, just based on everything. But I know the first week sometimes get a little bit hectic. So I don't want to promise having that out there when I know it might not be the case. So I think today, you know, it's the start of the regular season. This week, rosters are pretty much finalized. You know, I always say rosters really aren't finalized until Tuesday, but cutdowns were so early this year that I think you could probably say that as of Thursday, the rosters were pretty much finalized. A lot of people got confused by some of the veteran releases. I tried to throw a post together real quick on that, just to explain that veteran releases are a procedural thing. They're basically done to try to hide certain players from waivers, either release those players later after everyone has kind of done their claims. You know, on the first day that the waivers went out with all those players that got released, probably 20 to 25 players got claimed. After this, there's not a lot of claiming that goes on. There's a couple players here and there that will get claimed. But if you can get through that initial wave and you want to, you know, release somebody that's subject to waivers, you can usually get them through. So that's one reason. But the bigger reason really why is that you need to hold players on injured reserve who may come back. You know, basically players that have injuries that aren't going to hold them out the entire season, they have to actually be on the 53-man roster in order for you to use the rules in place to bring a player back from IR. Teams will wait, and what they'll do is you release a player like an Everson Griffin, a player that's got a minimum salary or close to it, and then you just re-sign them on the same exact contract. In some small instances, it'll be a player that has like a roster bonus for the first week of the league year, first week of the season, and some of those players just, you know, they'll lose that bonus when they come back. We had a couple players that had their salaries knocked down. This doesn't happen as much as it used to. This used to happen a lot more. Typically, what would happen is you would sign a restricted free agent to the lowest tender. This year, I think that's $2.133 million. And then what you would do is usually at the beginning of the summer, you'd say, hey, look, we can do a new deal for you. We'll guarantee you 1 million, take it or leave it. You know, it's either you're going to get cut or you get a million. Players at that point in time pretty much have to take it. We did see that with two players, Andrew Wiley on the Chiefs. He got his contracting down to a guaranteed 920, I believe. And one of the players the Lions claimed, and the name escapes me right now, but a very similar thing. You know, he goes from the RFA tender down to about a million. So that's what those are that kind of came through. Oh, and forgot to mention, so we are back on the little bit of some drinking. Now, when I record on Fridays, we probably still won't, because I think I'll still be going to the gym on Saturday mornings, unless I have stuff to do with the kids. But Saturday nights, we'll be back with doing that. So tonight is the Stone IPA. So it's a Stone IPA session tonight for the podcast. So, you know, if you're drinking along, hopefully you have something good. But I've cut about as much weight as I'm going to cut. So I'll wait until I go up a little bit more and then maybe cut down a little bit on the weekend, indulging in the beverages during the podcast. Just try to control the weight a little bit. So anyway, I think what we'll do today pretty much is just not even a big time regular season preview. You know, I think really what we're going to do is just take a look at just some thoughts on the season, you know, where the teams will go. I'm not going to get into, you know, all the numbers on the rosters and everything like that. Maybe next week I'll do that, because by the time I record next week and you guys listen to it, it's going to be after week one is done. So maybe we'll kind of do it then and just throw some stuff out there. And then I'll try to come up with a better timeline for doing this so we can actually do NFL predictions and stuff like that. Probably should do week one right now, but just kind of don't feel like doing that. So I don't think I'm going to do that. But I guess what I'll start with is just looking at the salaries for this year, just so you get an idea of the teams that are really kind of highly invested in this season. So let's take a look here at what teams have the most expensive rosters for the year. So you've got the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at number one. The roster value is about $244 million. This does include the practice squad. So this includes everybody that's been signed as of Thursday, I believe. The Buffalo Bills are at $242 million. The Browns, $237 million. Cowboys, $236 million. We've got the Indianapolis Colts, surprisingly, at $233 million. Now, the Colts do not have a big budget. But the acquisition of Carson Wentz, where we're going to count him as a, you know, $32 million contract, and they have him for a value that's more in the 20s, that's kind of one of the ways that the Colts have jumped up so high. San Francisco at 233, the Packers 232, Texans 229. I mean, what a disaster that is. You know, that's an owner that's got to be cursing himself. Chiefs 228. Saints 222, Titans 221, and the Patriots 218. If you go down on the cheap scale, so who are our teams that are the cheapest teams on the year? So let's look at our bottom 10. Let's see. Hopefully that's 10. So we've got the Jaguars at 195. We have the Jets, who lead the league with salaries on IR, at 194. We have the Bengals also at 194. We have the Eagles at 188. Now, that's a big drop for Philadelphia. Philadelphia, for about the last 3 or 4 years, has had one of the most, on paper, expensive rosters in the NFL. This is a byproduct of having all the salary cap issues and the fact that they really haven't had a lot of good drafts. So you don't have players to extend, and you don't have the ability to spend in free agency. Miami, after they purged their roster again this offseason, 188. Ravens, typically very low, 187. That number will jump if in some way, shape, or form they do a Lamar Jackson extension during the season. I guess it's possible. Chargers at 178. I thought they would have been a little bit higher than that. Carolina, 171. Carolina's, I don't know where they're headed right now. The Pittsburgh Steelers at 170. That is a complete salary cap related number. And the Falcons, 166 million. That is typically, like the Eagles, a ultra-high spender. They cannot spend. They've had to purge their roster because they are just a mess with the salary cap. As you look at the teams, you kind of look at the teams on top and you say, okay, these are the teams that have a lot invested in this season. You look at the teams on the bottom and say, you know what? If they happen to do well, they should be pretty happy about that. And when you look at the salary cap space for the teams, not this year, but next year, and I'm not going to count carryover in this, even though that obviously impacts things. When you look at some of these teams and you look at where their salary cap situations are next year, the Packers are $50 million over the cap next year. So if you are really talking about a win now team, the Saints, $37 million over. Cowboys, $26 million over. Minnesota, about $6 million over. The Rams, about $2.5 million over. The 49ers, about $2.9 over. And the Falcons, about $2 million over. $1.5 over. You look at those teams. Now, some of those teams have wiggle room. You know, the 49ers with Garoppolo and stuff like that. These are teams that are really all in on this season. You know, they need to do well this season because you're going to see a lot of changes next year. The Giants only have $700,000 in projected cap room. The Eagles about five. They have a decent amount of carryover that'll help them. Browns around five. You know, these are win now teams. The Bills at nine. When you see these teams that have low cap spaces, if things do not go well this year, what happens is those teams often go into a tailspin. They go into panic mode. You'll see executives that get fired. You'll see coaches that get fired. And you'll see the teams do a complete pullback, kind of like the Atlanta Falcons this year. So that's one of the reasons why when you look at cap space next year, it can really give you an idea of the amount of pressure that these rosters and these coaches are under to really perform this year at a very, very high level. And not all those teams are going to do well. You know, of some of those teams that I mentioned, I think the team, and we have a guest appearance by my daughter, Megan, used to be very little when I did this podcast years ago and then kind of put it on hiatus. You have anything to say, Megan?
Hi.
All right. So we got a hi from Megan. So not much has changed from when Megan was like 4 or 5 years old, and that's about all she would say. Now she's going to be 12, and she still says pretty much the same thing. She's visiting with Nelly since Nelly has just returned. Anyway, some of those teams they're not going to fire. And the team that I mentioned there is Minnesota. And Minnesota is the one that's really interesting because Minnesota, if you talk about a team that's going sideways and you can't figure out what they're doing, they just did a $16 million extension for like a 32-year-old safety. I mean, there is no logic in that. You know, great for him. I mean, that's awesome for him, for Harrison Smith to get that deal. He's been an incredible player. It's just wild to me that when you look at these things, I would actually say that when he was younger and a really good player, they were able to play more hardball, I would think, with him and get a stronger contract than they got now. I think most people looked at that and said, what are you doing? You know, where does this benefit you as a team? Does it get you away from a contract headache this year? I guess it's near impossible to think that a player who's 32, 33 years old will get more money on this contract in the first 2 years than he would at two franchise tags. Yeah, I get that if the player's 26, 27 and as good as Harrison Smith. At this age, I mean, that is a much, much, much more difficult thing to do. And it's a team. When you look at the things they've done, you know, they've set themselves up kind of for disaster. You know, I looked at them last year when they made that Diggs trade, and I said, you know, I'm going to be in the minority on this and say they're trying to retool and they're trying to get their salary cap in order so they can make another run at it. That they kind of looked at where they went and they said, this is as far as we've gotten. And I was completely wrong on that. I was 100% wrong as to what Minnesota was doing. That was very clearly that they had a problem with the player, because they've just done things that just don't make a lot of sense in terms of trying to build yourself out of a 7-9, 8-8 kind of hole and into like a more powerful team. And you can already see the negativity on Kirk Cousins swarming online. Last year, it was much quieter. It was still there, but not to the point that I saw in a preseason game while I was away. The comments that were out on my timeline, and it wasn't by, you know, kind of typical, I think more people who get into the side of, you know, Cousins is kind of a low upside quarterback kind of stuff. It was the Mike Florio part of the world where they were talking about decisions that he was making on third down. When you've crossed that threshold, you've hit the Matt Schaub in Houston era. You've hit the Chad Pennington with the Jets era, where you get national commentators that really start drilling home this idea that the guy doesn't have an arm, guy doesn't take risks, the guy just isn't a good quarterback. It's not a good place to be as a team when that's where you're at. You know, there was a little bit of this at the early part of last year. Might have been two games in. I had to write a post about his contract because they had just re-signed him and where it was going to be. But that was more specific to kind of smaller things I was seeing on Twitter, that more was in the direct football universe versus the bigger macroverse of football. And it puts you as an organization in a really bad position because it puts you at a point where you're kind of forced to defend why someone's your quarterback or pull him from the roster or pull him from the starting job. So I think if you look at teams and you look at a team that's like really volatile for this year, I think it's Minnesota. I think you're looking at a pricey roster of a team that probably doesn't have a lot of direction. And, you know, I think that's a team that could really blow up. But anyway, let's just go division by division here. We'll just give some thoughts. I'd like to say that, you know, I crunched the numbers and I really went through this stuff, but not really. I mean, this is just going to be my opinions on it. So this is going to be much less, I think, in depth than most of the stuff we do. It's just going to be more a couple opinions on a team. So we'll go division by division. We'll look at the Vegas Insider win-loss here, their predicted win totals. See where we go with that. So in the AFC East, we've got the Buffalo Bills, Miami Dolphins, New England Patriots, and New York Jets. I would think even if the Buffalo Bills, even if Josh Allen doesn't play as well as last year, and let's be honest, he's probably not going to play as well as last year. He was off the charts last year with a lot of the stuff he did. That was not the case the first 2 years of his career. And he had an MVP kind of season last year. Usually you don't get that 2 years in a row. For a lot of players, even when you look at the Dan Marinos and the Tom Brady's, you know, when they would hit those high highs, they would come down to earth to where you'd still have great seasons, but you know, you wouldn't be ridiculous like you were the year before. I think Buffalo is still the class of that division. I think they're well coached. The GM in that division is, I think, far and away the best general manager in that division. I think you can argue he's the best general manager in the NFL at this point. So I think they have the infrastructure in place to deal with a Josh Allen kind of pullback. They've got good players that can kind of pick him up if things go down. They don't have much in the way of a running game. Who cares? I don't think any of that matters. They're going to go out there and they're going to pass the ball. You know they're going to pass the ball. He's got the arm to make plays even if things go bad. The question is, if he does start to turn the ball over a lot, do they kind of put a little bit more of a leash on him? I don't think they will. Their win total this year looks like it's 11. I think I would go over for them. When you look at who they play this year, let's just pull up. I'm not going to pull up their whole schedule. But they do play it's not the easiest of schedules here. You know, you do play the NFC South, which in theory should be a decent division. But you also play the AFC South, which should be a terrible division. And I think the Bills can kind of beat up a little bit on the other teams in the East. So I think I'd go over 11 on the Bills. I don't know who you would put in second. As you look at the teams there, you've got New England and the Jets, who kind of have that unknown as a quarterback. And then you've got Miami, who also is a bit of an unknown as a quarterback. I can't put Miami up there. I don't think Miami's roster is very good. Tua was so bad last year. I know that how bad you are as a rookie a lot of times doesn't mean anything, you know, unless you're Josh Rosen, I guess. But I can't picture them playing well with the way he played last season. The way he played at the end of last season, he looked like he wasn't an NFL quarterback. Even in the one game, and maybe he had a couple games like that, but the one game where he threw for probably 350 yards or something like that, it just, it doesn't look like what other quarterbacks do. So I have a hard time, you know, kind of putting them in there. Their number is 9.5. I would definitely go under on them. I would not be surprised if they end up being fourth in that division. I think the Patriots, Jets, and Dolphins will all be close, but I wouldn't be surprised if Miami lands in fourth. New England obviously has the most proven coach. They can do a lot of things with smoke and mirrors there. They're old team on defense. They've spent a lot of money. I don't understand the money that they spent. They're going to start the rookie quarterback after they release Cam Newton. Cam Newton was not vaccinated, which I'm sure played a role in it. You know, he lost this job really because he missed time because of the whole COVID thing. I have no idea what he was thinking with all that stuff, but whatever. I think Cam Newton's career is probably over in the NFL. The question is, with the way that they play, I'm going to assume that Belichick is going to approach this with kind of kid's gloves. I think he's going to try to go back to what he did in Brady's first year, which really was a lot of defense kind of concepts. I don't know if the stuff works in today's NFL, but I kind of think that he's going to go back to that and see what they can do. The personnel is not as good as it was back then, so I don't know. At 9.5, I'd probably go under on them as well. And then you've got the New York Jets, who the Jets over-under is 6. And I'm going to go over on that for the Jets. That's not a homer prediction for the Jets. The Jets, even with all the injuries they already have, are a better team than they were last year. Just by the fact of getting Adam Gase out of there, that already makes you a better team. All right, that's it. The Jets, I think, have a lot of things going for them. I think having a new head coach, being a team that was absolutely terrible last year, so there's no expectations for you to be good. I think both of those things work in your favor. You've got a quarterback nobody knows anything about. Everyone on your schedule is going to pencil you in as a win. When that happens, those are the kind of years where these teams kind of come out of nowhere and are competitive. Now, I don't anticipate the Jets competing for the playoffs, but I do think the Jets this year could be an 8-win team. So I think I would put the Jets over, but I don't think any of those three teams are really going to compete for the playoffs. I think they're just going to be very tight together for who is number 2, 3, and 4 in that division. I will say this about the Jets. The Jets once again kind of came out and said, hey, look, this is not playoff expectations. This is all about, you know, kind of building an identity, building a team together, having the quarterback learn. I'm fine with that. At some point in time, ownership has to come out and say the playoffs have to happen. How many years in a row can we go with the Johnson saying, no, the playoffs aren't a priority? You know, this dates back to McCagnan being there. Really, it dates back probably to Idzik. There's no mandate for the playoffs. There's no thought that the playoffs are a goal. It's like the playoffs would be nice. It's not a goal. I'm going to say the only year where maybe since 2013 that the playoffs have been an explicit goal was 2016, the year after they went 10-6 and they brought a lot of those guys back. I think the playoffs were a consideration then. Maybe not explicitly, but they were at least a consideration. Definitely ever since then, and probably those years after Tannenbaum got fired, it's always been like, well, no, we're building for next year. We're building for next year. We're building for next year. At some point, next year is here. You know, Joe Douglas has had 2 drafts. He's had 3 years of signing players. At some point, you have to look at this and say, you can't just keep being in the top 10. You can't be the Jacksonville Jaguars. So I hope after this year, ownership will actually come out and say that the goal is the playoffs. Because if they don't, you know, it's really hard, you know, as a fan of that team. You know, I've grown completely just whatever with the team because of the way things have gone over the last couple of years. I don't expect the playoffs to be a consideration this year. It's just, it's hard to hear from everybody within that organization every single year. No, it's not a goal. You know, everybody should have that goal. So anyway, let's move on. So we move on to the AFC North. where last year the order of finish was Pittsburgh, Baltimore, Cleveland, Cincinnati. So if you look at them this year, they play the AFC West. They play the NFC North. That's not a great look of a schedule. So I think that will be somewhat difficult there. I think you've got some decent teams in the AFC West. So that's pretty tough. And you've got a couple teams, I guess, in the NFC side that could at least be somewhat dangerous. So I think as you look at these teams, I would say Baltimore is still going to be the class of that division. You know, Baltimore's over-under is 11. I think I would probably go over, maybe not by much, but I think I would go over for them. Incredibly well coached. Harbaugh doesn't get enough credit for the job that he's done there all these years. They do have a dynamic quarterback. They can't play from behind. I know people are going to say, well, they don't play. They haven't had a chance to play from behind a lot. They're not a team that's built to play from behind. That's not the way they play, but they're built to gain leads. They do very well, I think, in their preparation each week. Did the league catch up to Jackson last year? Yeah, will they catch up a little bit more this year? They probably will. I think he needs to develop more as a passer for Baltimore to probably take that next step. But I think Baltimore is the class of that division, and that would be surprising if they didn't, you know, win that division to me. Now you run into the next three teams. I think Cincinnati actually has a chance to be the second team in this division. Cincinnati's over-under is 6.5. I'm definitely going to go over on Cincinnati this year. I think the coaching staff is probably a negative. I don't think they stand out in any way, shape, or form. So I think you might be a little bit worried about that. But they have a couple players on offense that could be dynamic. Burrow at times showed last year that he could be the real deal at quarterback. I think he has that chance to take that step forward, assuming that he's going to be healthy. They do have a couple players on defense that I think can kind of work into some of these games. But I think when you look at the teams in the division and you look at the way some of those teams play, I think Cincinnati can match up with them. I think Cincinnati has a benefit of youth. I think when teams like Pittsburgh are probably going to end up being more grinded out affairs, you can beat teams like that. So I think Cincinnati will take a big leap, and I think Cincinnati has a chance to be a playoff team this year. Pittsburgh was a 12-win team last season. This year, their over-under is 8.5. That's a pretty tough one to call. I think that's a perfect number for them because they're probably going to be either an 8 or 9 win team right on kind of the outskirts of the playoffs. Pittsburgh is also well coached. The thing that worries me about Pittsburgh is that the last 2 years, they've really been good defensively. And you say, well, why does that worry you? I don't know how you can do that 3 years in a row. Haven't really made a lot of changes. If anything, they've probably gone negative on that side of the ball. So that would worry me. And obviously, then you've got the quarterback situation. Here's the one thing that you might see with Pittsburgh this year, and I wouldn't be surprised by this at all. You may have Roethlisberger have a good September, and there'll be all this talk about Roethlisberger's back and, you know, the rest and the arm and everything else, and then it's going to fall off after 4 weeks. Now, Roethlisberger might have the Aaron Rodgers resurgence. I would not be surprised if you basically get a fall arm that's good, and then the arm falls off as the winter months come along, and they're put in a totally different position. So I until I see something different, gosh, I don't know where I would put them with that. I guess I would go under, because I think the downside in Pittsburgh is much higher than the upside. So I think I would lean the under for them. I guess they'll be right around there. But I think there's a lot of negatives with Pittsburgh that stand out that I'd be worried about. Cleveland, 10.5 wins. I would definitely go under on Cleveland. I know a lot of people are very high on the Browns. Last year, everything goes in the Browns' favor. You've got the rookie head coach, catches a lot of teams by surprise. I don't think that there's a lot of teams expecting a lot from them. Schedule broke down really well. Bounce of the ball went okay for them. They had games where they did well. They had games where they did not. I think everything that you look at with Cleveland would scream, this is a team that's probably going to get worse. even though most people will probably put them as the third best team, I would guess, in the AFC. I just don't see it. Baker Mayfield has to take a step forward for them to get over 10.5 wins, I think. I don't think that you can have the type of year that he had for at least half the season last year. Some will say, well, he did close stronger. He did. You're going to deal with Beckham back in the lineup. I don't think he's meshed well with Beckham at all. I think he played better when Beckham was out, to be honest. You're going to have to deal with feeding Beckham and Landry. I don't know. You know, their running game comes into play if they are up and then they just kind of bludgeon you in the fourth quarter. I don't think that they can play kind of like I said with Baltimore from behind, but I don't think the Browns are built to just always get ahead. They remind me a little bit of the Titans, and obviously the Titans ended up really good again last year. So maybe that will happen with them, but I would go under on Cleveland. I think the only surefire team in this is Baltimore. And I think, like I said, I think Cincinnati is definitely a playoff contender in here. We move on to the AFC South. This is just like, where do you go? You know, who is the team that makes it here? Because it's very hard to look at any of these teams and say it's a positive. You know, you look at Tennessee. Did Tennessee get better? You know, they did add Julio Jones. But they're still going to be relying on Henry to some extent. Their defense still isn't very good. So I don't know if you can look at them and say, well, you know, they should be better again. Indianapolis is well coached. They're definitely a team that I think has they have a low ceiling, but they also have kind of a low floor. They're very unexciting. You know, they did finish with 11 wins last year. They scream of a team that's like in the 16 game sense, would always be like right around 9 wins. You know, a team that probably if they played in a different division might not be a playoff team, but would be kind of in contention for that wild card in weeks 15, 16, 17. You know, if the coin flips right, you know, maybe things go their way. You've got Houston, who is just atrocious. And then you got Jacksonville that's kind of an unknown. Like with the Jets, I think Jacksonville has a couple things going for it. The one difference I would say is because of the identity of the coach, the name identity of the coach, the brand value of the head coach, and the brand value of the quarterback that they drafted, there are going to be more expectations on Jacksonville when they play against teams than the Jets. So I do think that's the one thing working in the Jets' favor, but I think Jacksonville does have a lot of those same checkboxes as the Jets, where you look at them and you say, okay, it's a new coach, it's a new quarterback, it's a new everything, it's new life. And those are the things where you get teams that surprise. Would I be stunned if Jacksonville won the AFC South? The answer is no. I don't think I would be surprised by that. Their over-under is, let's see, Tennessee, Indy, both at 9. Jacksonville 6.5. So yeah, I'm definitely over on Jacksonville. This reminds me, you know, if Lawrence is as good as they say, people talk about him as kind of a once in a lifetime prospect, probably an overblown phrase, but whatever. This reminds me a bit of Andrew Luck as a rookie. What happened there was you didn't have a particularly good football team, but you had a really good football player. You had a team that other opponents really weren't that prepared for, maybe didn't even take that seriously. The Colts would go out there and the Colts would beat a lot of teams. I'm going to say they might have won 11 games in his first year, maybe 10, 11, I don't know. They'd get the doors blown off them when they would match up against good teams, just get wiped out. But I think that there could be that same potential here. When you look at some of the teams that they play against, when you look at the AFC South, they're going to match up against the AFC East, which is not a lot of good football teams. And they're going to play the NFC West, which probably has some better teams. But I think between beating up on each other, beating up on the teams in the East, or playing against some of those teams in the East, I think you have a chance for an 11-win football team. And I think 11 wins probably gets you this division. I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say Jacksonville will win that division. I think Indianapolis will be second, even though they have Carson Wentz. I think they can compete even with really mediocre play at quarterback. Tennessee, I think I would put third. I think Tennessee has a higher ceiling than Indianapolis, but I don't anticipate Henry being the type of closer that he's been the last 2 years. So I think they're going to lean on him and end up losing some of those games that they probably won in the past where, you know, he'll rip off an 80-yard run or something at the end of a football game to, you know, put them up. You know, it's kind of the kiss of death, the dagger right at the end of the game. I would not be surprised if it's 2-3 yards and some dust and that's about it, you know, and lets teams kind of come back on them. Both of those teams, their over-under is 9. I think they're both going to be right on the number, right around that. If I had to choose, I would go over on the Colts and I would go under on the Titans, but I think they're probably going to be right at that number. The Texans are just a bad team. I don't know what the Texans are going to do with anything, really. They're over-under. It's got to be the lowest in the league is 4. Could you really go under 4 when you play 17? That's hard to do, but I mean, Tyrod Taylor can play a little bit. I don't know much about the coach there. God, they just seem like they're in such disarray. I would probably go under on Houston, even though there's no real reason for them to be under that. I don't know. I just have a hard time seeing them do anything. So I guess I would go under, even though projecting a team under 4 just seems like lunacy. So you know what? Actually, I'm going to change my mind on that. I can't go under 4. That's just such a low number. You know, so I would go over. They're still going to stink, but they should be able to get to 5 or 6 wins, I guess. I'll go over on Houston, but I don't like their prospects. I just can't go under 4. That just seems absurd. Let's see. We've got the AFC West coming up. So I don't think there's any reason to pick anybody but Kansas City. I would say if there's a team that you go for there, it's the Chargers. That would be the other option. You know, you have the Chargers with the young quarterback and some veteran pieces there around him, with hopefully a new outlook on football. You've got the Broncos that are more of that veteran team, but I can't take the Broncos serious with their quarterbacks. And then you've got the Raiders who, I don't know, the Raiders just nothing they do makes sense right now from a personnel standpoint. You know, they're redoing contracts right now just so they can comply with the cap. Their roster's not good enough to where they should be fighting with the cap. And the roster hasn't been good enough in the last couple of years to where they should be fighting with the salary cap. Like that shouldn't be an issue for the Raiders, but maybe fighting is not the right word, but that's where they are. And they're making moves to sign KJ Wright. I mean, come on, another linebacker? It's a different era. I don't understand when people want to claim that John Gruden's not running the show there. Look at what they do with the construction of that roster, and you tell me that's not John Gruden. They're building a football team the way you built a football team 15 years ago. Maybe that can be successful, but they're building a team like you built a team 15 years ago. That's not anything to do with modern NFL. Anyway, the over-unders for these teams here, let's take a look. We've got the Chiefs at 12.5. That's a high number. I would go over on the Chiefs. I think the schedule is easy enough for them to get there. We've got the Chargers at 9.5. I'm going to go over on the Chargers. I love what I saw from the quarterback last year. If he can take another little step forward, I think that they have that ability to be like the Falcons were years ago when Matt Ryan kind of moved into his prime. Denver is 8.5. I'm going to go under on Denver. I think that defense is going to be terrific. They're not going to go anywhere with that offense. They have a couple receivers. Quarterback is just whatever. By moving off of Locke now, I don't see how you can go back to him. You know, I think the right path there was to give Locke a couple of games, see if he could do anything. And if he couldn't, then you go to Bridgewater. Everyone's all happy about the switch at that point in time. Maybe you kick yourself if you started 0-2 or 0-3 and you didn't have Bridgewater in there. But, you know, if you go 1-2 with Bridgewater, it's like, I don't know. I just don't see what that gives you. So I don't really understand that move. Denver should have drafted a quarterback. I think this is just a sign of mismanagement of, you know, what they've done. So I'm going to go under on them at 8.5. I don't think they're going to be far under that. I think they're too fundamentally sound to be far under. Then you got the Raiders at 7. That's a tough call as well. You know I sounded incredibly negative on the Raiders. I'm negative on the Raiders personnel. I'm positive on the Raiders head coach. Not when he puts on the GM hat, but I think he can usually finagle some wins out of a team that he has no business winning. So I'd probably go over on the Raiders there. You know, it's a good division. You know, they're going to beat up on some of these teams that they play against. You know, I think you probably have the Broncos and the Raiders right around 8 is where they would be. I think that's where I would put those teams. You know, if I had to choose one of those two teams to be like much worse, I think I would actually choose Denver. I have more confidence in Carr and Gruden, I think, than I have with the Bridgewater group. So I think if I had to actually choose one to have the bottom fall out, I think it'd be Denver more so than Vegas. God, I have a hard time calling them Vegas. Anyway, let's move on to the NFC East, where we've got the football team, 7 wins last year, Giants at 6, Dallas at 6, Philadelphia at 4.5 last year. Dallas, if Dak Prescott is healthy, that might be a big if at this point. Dallas should run away with this division. They have a 9 as their win total. I'm going to go over on Dallas. Dallas is just so much better, I think, than these other teams. Their personnel on offense is really, really, really good. That alone should win you some games. I know with Prescott in there last year, they didn't start out record-wise as well as you would hope. I think that was just bad luck in a couple of spots there. I'm bullish on Dallas. I know a lot of people are not. Now, Prescott's got some stuff that's concerning, but I would go over on them, and I think they're the clear class of the division. You got Washington at 8.5. I'm going to go under on Washington. They do have Fitzmagic. He's a fun quarterback. He's not really a winning quarterback. He does just enough to tease you into thinking you're a good football team, and you end up not being one. Head coach is good enough to be solid, you know, for them to probably be a 7 or 8 win football team. But I don't see them as being anything more than that. You have the Giants at 6.5. I'm going to go under on the Giants as well. I'm sorry, the Giants are at 7, and I'm still obviously going to go under if I was going to go under at 6.5. I'm going to go under on the Giants. I think the Giants spent a lot of money. I don't think there was any plan for what they did. I think it's all haphazard spending. I don't think it'll pay off. I think Galladay has that look of a player who might end up being on the shelf a lot. The question would be, does Daniel Jones take a jump? You know, if he does take that Josh Allen leap, if he's that 1 in a million that does that, you've got a different story. But I'd be concerned with them. Ingram's banged up already. Galladay's been banged up. They don't really have a lot on defense, I don't think. They're overpaid in some spots. I don't see it at all. Barkley's back. I don't know if that's even really going to mean anything. He might give you, you know, one screen pass that he takes to the house. The question is, how many touches are you going to have to give him to get that big play? And I think that's a problem for them, is that, yeah, Barkley is exciting. Barkley can give you a big play. He gives you a lot of nothingness plays to get that big play. While big plays are important in the NFL, having to do a whole bunch of nothing plays is not good for you at all. Philadelphia is at 6.5. I'm also going under on Philadelphia. I think Philadelphia stinks right now. There's just nothing there. I don't think the quarterbacks look good. I don't think that they're convinced that the quarterback is any good. I think they are in a complete rebuild mode at this point, and I think they'll be under, and I think they'll make sure that they get under if things start going south and they have an opportunity to be a top draft pick. I think they'll make certain that they don't win that many games. You go to the NFC North. This is one of the most interesting divisions. I already mentioned about Minnesota. You've got Green Bay. So Green Bay's total for this year is 10. That's a tricky number. I think that that's a real tricky number because everything is based on Aaron Rodgers last year. Aaron Rodgers last year was not like Aaron Rodgers the year before or the year before that. I don't think it's logical to think Aaron Rodgers is going to come back and have anything close to the type of year he had last season. He's upset with the team. You're probably going to get comments all season long about the personnel, which is probably going to rip the locker room apart. Left tackle's already sidelined for a while. Adam's probably unhappy with his contract. I think there's a lot of distractions in Green Bay. I'm going to go under on Green Bay. I think if Green Bay makes the playoffs, which they might do, they could be dangerous, I guess, in the playoffs if the quarterback gets hot or whatever. I'm going to go under. I'm going to go negative on the Packers for this season. The question then is, well, who do you go positive on? Minnesota at 9? I think Minnesota is the team that does have a potential. I don't know. They do have a potential, I think, high ceiling, as crazy as that is with Cousins. Defensively, I think they stink. Offensively, it's just going to depend on Cousins, and I think there's going to be so much on the outside coming there. I'm going to say no, and I'm going to go under on Minnesota. The team I'm going to go over on is Chicago. Chicago's at 7.5. Chicago has a lot of defensive talent. I know that they have like nobody in the secondary this year, you know, at least compared to where they were last year. Their salary cap is a mess. They have some really, really, really bad player contracts. Feet are absolutely to the fire this year. I think Chicago is going to be over. I think Chicago will compete with Green Bay for the top spot in the division. I think if Chicago makes the turn to Fields, they have a better shot than if they go with Dalton. You know, Dalton probably makes them a bit like Minnesota, but I think they have better personnel overall than Minnesota has at this point. So I'm going to go bullish on Chicago, and I'm going to give Chicago a chance to win that division. I don't know what it will take. You know, if Green Bay is at 9, can Chicago get to 10? Yeah, I think that's probably going to be around the number that wins that division. I think these are teams that are all going to have weeks where people say they're good, and then they'll have a stretch of games where people say they're bad. And then you got the Lions, who I think are really bad. The Lions are 4.5 on the over-under. And I know I went crazy about Houston before. I'm going to go under on Detroit. I just don't see anything there. I just don't see anything on offense that's going to make them stand out other than the fact that the coach wants to eat your knees or something. I don't really see anything on defense that makes them stand out. I look at this as just a complete overhaul project. I don't know. I just don't see it. Will they catch a couple teams by surprise? I mean, maybe they will. I don't know. I just don't see anything. There's nothing with that team that that stands out to me. As crazy as it sounds, I'm going to go under, even though it's just a 4.5 number. I think that that's just where I'm going to go with that. We've got the NFC South. We've got the Saints last year at 12, Tampa at 11, Carolina 5, and Atlanta 4. Who's the top team in this division? And obviously, you have the big change at quarterback for New Orleans. And Tampa Bay is stayed completely the same. I'm going to say New Orleans is still going to be the best team in that division. I know it's going to sound a little bit wild. I think they have the best roster. I think they have the best head coach. I think they're prepared for this. I think that they made the right call going with Jameis Winston. I still firmly believe that this was all part of his plan last year when they did not play him to make sure that they couldn't lose him in free agency. Now, I'm not saying that he's gonna light the world on fire, but I think he's more than capable of playing within that offense. They have a lot of good defensive talent there. They can play both sides of the ball if they have to. Drew Brees the last 2 years has not been Drew Brees from his prime. They've been a dominant football team despite having a really what amounts to a mid-grade quarterback these last 2 years. So unless Winston just gets turnover happy, which is possible, I think that that's still the class of that division, and I'm definitely going over 9. You've got Tampa Bay at 12. I'm going to go under on Tampa. I think Tampa's win total is way too high just based on winning the Super Bowl last year. They were an 11-win team last year. I know you get that extra game. I don't think that they'll be any better than 11. I wouldn't be surprised if they just get to 10. I know it's Tom. I know he's incredible. You know, all the accolades that you could give. They're coming back with basically the same team. That doesn't usually work. That probably worked 30 years ago. I don't think that works anymore, at least not to that extent. So I'm going to go under with Tampa. I still think they'd clearly be a playoff team, but I would go under on them. Then you've got the Atlanta Falcons, who have a 7.5 number, and the Carolina Panthers, who are also at 7.5. So of those two teams, I think Atlanta is better than Carolina. I think Carolina is a clear under. You're going with Sam Darnold, who's been terrible. I don't know what you're hoping for there with him. So I think I would definitely go under. I think that's a big project in Carolina, their rebuilding project. They weren't left with a good infrastructure, probably haven't done enough to kind of build up their infrastructure. You know, they've kind of built certain things on the line. They're probably too reliant on the running back. They have a decent wide receivers. They should have drafted a quarterback this year. I don't understand why they did not. I'm going to go under on them. I'm going to go, oh man, on Atlanta. It's really tough. I mean, the quarterback is good. I know he's getting older. He's still good. They have weapons on offense. Defensively, they can't stop anybody. I'm going to go over just because they do play the two East divisions. So I think that gives you a fighting chance against both because you're kind of playing against bad teams. I'm going to take Matt Ryan over a lot of those quarterbacks on those opposing teams they're going to play. So I'm going to go over on them. They're probably an 8-win team this year. They're still a team. Look, if Atlanta wins eight games, 9 games, 10 games, you can't double down on the roster they have. Atlanta needs to kind of start to turn things over. They need to make more changes next year. That's also a big project, kind of like Carolina, like Detroit. You know, Carolina's number could jump just, I guess, based on schedule. I just don't see them as an 8-win team. I don't see that happening. You know, I think they're just going to be under that 7.5 figure. Finally, get to the NFC West, and that is a fun division for me. You've got Seattle, you got the Rams, you got the Cardinals, you got the 49ers. I mean, I think that you go around and ask a lot of people and you'd get a lot of different answers as to who is the best and who is the worst team in that division. Who do I think is the best team in that division? So I'm going to go with Seattle. Seattle's over under is 10. Seattle has that, I don't know, they've got the best quarterback. I don't think there's any question about that at all. The question is, how much do they let the quarterback play? Maybe they haven't let him play enough at times, but the formula that they have used in Seattle has been successful for basically a decade. Could it have been more successful if things went different? Maybe so, but it's been successful for like a decade. Their over-under is 10. I think they'll be over, and I think they'll probably win that division. You've got the Rams and the 49ers both at 10.5. Both are interesting teams. The Rams have gone all in. You know, if the Rams do not win this year, they're kind of at a point of no return. I don't really even know where the Rams would go. Stafford, in my mind, is not a high-end quarterback. I don't know how he's going to fit in with some of the players that they have there. He is an upgrade over Jared Goff. I think I would go over on the Rams. But I don't think they'll win the division. I think Seattle is better than LA. I think so. You know, Wilson's a better quarterback than Stafford. They have better personnel, I think, in Seattle on offense if they utilize it. The Rams have a better secondary, obviously, you know, which can go a long way. But I think Seattle's still better. San Francisco is kind of like a dark horse to me. I think people are way too bullish on them. I think there is a lot of love for the head coach because of concepts that he does. I think at this point, he's still a better coordinator than a head coach. Maybe that changes. But I think the way he runs the offense is probably better than the performance overall of the team. I just don't see the personnel offensively. you know, they've got this fun stuff that they might do with both quarterbacks in there, you know, where you kind of use Lance in certain situations. Defensively, they have a couple players. They lost their defensive coordinator to the Jets. I don't know. I would go under on them. I think people are too bullish on San Francisco right now. Would I be surprised if they won that division? I don't think I'd be surprised by it. If I was putting money on it, I would put San Francisco under. I think they'll probably be closer to, you know, 9 wins, 8 wins than they will 11. Then finally you have Arizona. Arizona's at 8.5. Arizona has to win. Arizona, if you look at a team that's in a must-win spot, Arizona's in a must-win spot. You've got Murray on the third year of his rookie contract. You've got a team with all these old players that they've signed, older players that they've signed. You know, Arizona, to me, is the mirror image of the Colts years ago, where you've got a pretty good quarterback and probably not a very good job of constructing a roster around him. And you've kind of done some weird things with older players and whatnot to try to build this roster with names that isn't necessarily that good. The head coach has not stood out in any way, shape, or form. The question just is, can Murray take, you know, a bigger step to take another leap forward to carry a team that probably shouldn't, you know, has no business being over 9 wins. I think I'm going to go under on Arizona. I think I'm going to go under and they're going to fire everybody. I think that's a team that has that potential to really implode. And who knows, maybe even be a team where some coaches do not make it through the entire season. I just don't like the way that team has been built. The 8.5 wins is based strictly on the fact that quarterback is there. That's really it. You know, he's dynamic. He can be really dynamic at times. But I don't know. I'm going to go under on them and say that everybody gets fired in Arizona. And then they wonder if they wasted the Murray years in Arizona. All right. Before I get to questions here, I think one of the things that I want to talk about a little bit is just a comment that I made on Twitter. Now, I know some of this comes down to let me switch beers here, by the way. We're moving to something else. We've run out of our stones, so we're on a Dogfish Head now. One of the comments that I made this week dealt with Urban Meyer said something where he basically, you know, said that COVID, you know, the vaccination status, was a criteria that they used whether or not they were going to release players. You know, I made a comment that was like they need somebody to kind of bring him in check, because you can't say those things, you know, because the owners and the Players Association basically made this agreement that you couldn't cut players because of COVID, because of vaccination. And of course, that got a lot of blowback. There was a lot of comments that were, you know, one, the Jaguars have a passionate fan base. I've dealt with making negative comments about the Jaguars before and then having the Jaguar Nation come after you. Always entertaining, you know, with some of the stuff. But I thought a lot of people took that, and maybe this is just an issue with how we are all the time, as like a political vaccine thing. I've got vaccinated. I've talked about that before. You know, I talked about whatever reactions that I had to it. I didn't see any negatives to getting a vaccine. I don't think there's any issues with it. The issue just is more with the fact that the NFL kind of created this fake little bubble, both them and the Players Association, because they didn't want to deal with getting involved with this concept of forcing people to get vaccinated, which they should have done. But neither side wanted to do it. You know, the NFL didn't want to get involved with that aspect of it, and the Players Association didn't want to have their players fighting for stuff that they didn't want to do. You ended up with this weird thing where they come to this agreement where basically they're going to put in as many penalties as possible if you're not vaccinated, but you can't overtly come out and say that vaccination is the reason that a player didn't get a job. The Jaguars had to walk his comments back. The PA was going to look to see if they could investigate this, you know, to file a grievance possibly. That was really more my take on it. It was just a football take. You know, if you're a head coach of a team, if you're a general manager of a team, a lot of your job is public relations, right? It's PR. It's understanding the rules, understanding what you can or can't say. In many ways, you're like a politician. He's already kind of said some things that probably shouldn't have been said. And it's not like he was making this grand statement of, well, you know, you should be vaccinated. He wasn't. That's not what it was. It was an off-the-cuff remark to a question about what goes into the process. And it was, well, you know, part of it is whether the player's vaccinated or whether he's not vaccinated. That's all it was. And it was just a mistake because now you open yourself up to a potential grievance where, and I'm not going to even say that I know the penalties because I don't, but, you know, I would imagine with a lot of these grievances, you know, you can lose a draft pick. Obviously, you can get fined personally. The organization can get fined. You might have a grievance from a player who's not vaccinated and now gets his salary, so you lose some cap space. I mean, all those things can possibly play a role. If you're mad about him not being allowed to say it, or someone like me saying, well, he shouldn't say it, the anger for that really should be directed at the league. The league is the one, or the Players Association, maybe both of them, that came up with this stupid rule that kind of forces teams to have to walk around it, skirt the issue, because they don't want to get into political discourse on a vaccine. I still don't understand why there is any politics involved in a vaccine. It's all about just science, or I don't know, it's just public health. I mean, I just don't get the politics aspect of it, but it's become political and the league just doesn't want to be involved with it. But I just wanted to mention it only because there was so much on that topic. You know, I just think that there was a better way for him to handle that as a football coach. You know, if he would have come out and just been making comments to be a stern supporter of getting vaccinated, you know, that's something different. But this was more just like not understanding the rules. To me, this was the equivalent of like a coach that tampers with a player in a public forum with a player's contract in a public forum because they don't realize they're not supposed to talk about it. That was the way more that I took that situation than anything else. But I just want to mention it only because there was so much that came about on Twitter for that. So anyway, let's do some questions here. So I know I'm going to miss some questions that came in email only because I am so far behind on those. So I'm just going to try to find them here because I know I got a couple. Let's see. I'll go to email first, then I'll go to Twitter, and I will catch up on emails very shortly. Now, this one's from John. I think the NFL and NFLPA have been operating under the assumption that COVID would be a one-year hit to the cap and revenue. However, with recent cases on the rise and hospitalizations up and a lockdown or at least limitations in gatherings doesn't seem out of the realm of possibilities. Is there another season of limited fans? What does this do to the cap? Are the NFL and NFLPA having these discussions? And how would this impact this year and future caps? In the past, you talked about how the COVID season would not impact top-end players. However, if the rebound in salary cap back to the 200 plus million range will take another 3 to 4 years, how do you see salaries impacted? My guess is that part of the reason that they put a cap on the salary cap this year, not a floor, but a cap, is they want to leave enough wiggle room to get rid one of all the COVID from last year. But I think the other possibility is if the stands were not full. My guess is the NFL's revenue expectations this year is probably 70% full, which means local revenues would probably be 80% of, you know, what they were pre-COVID versus last year where they were probably like 40 or 50%. So I think they've baked in that possibility. I don't think, and I hope not, I have a hard time believing that we're going to go back to kind of a lockdown state. I know that with the fall, things could go sideways, but I mean, if you look, most schools are back, most are functioning. Adults have a pretty high vaccination rate, I think, throughout the U.S. So I do believe that the season will go off, at least most of it. You know, I think you're looking at right now, you know, if you look at all the negative press that came with the Delta variant, with all the focus really that was on Florida for that time, Florida still never hit the tailspins of New York, New Jersey last year in March. For as bad as Florida's been and all of the bad stuff that came out of Florida over the last month and a half. I think most people have agreed that they kind of hit their peak and have started to, I don't know, kind of temper out. There was never, this was not COVID phase one that really hit the area where I live incredibly strong, especially with the older communities. So I have to believe that the vaccine has worked significantly towards that. So I would think the only way the league would have that limited amount of fans is if we did enter that lockdown phase again. I just don't see it happening. The big negatives with these areas where they've had like nothing in place, I don't think have been, and thankfully, nearly devastating enough to where you would happen, you know, you'd have to have that happen, you know. And so then the question would be, well, are certain states going to potentially put more restrictions than others? And it's a possibility. I can't say that it's not, but I don't picture New Jersey saying the Giants and Jets can't have fans. I don't picture New York saying the Bills can't have fans. Yeah, maybe I could California. I'm not positive on that. But, you know, Florida is not going to put anything in place. Texas is not going to put anything in place. Louisiana is probably not putting anything in place. You start to go state by state, and I think really it's only a handful of states where you would even think it's a possibility. I just don't see it. So I don't think it's going to be an issue. Certainly with the season about to kick off, I don't think it would be an issue until you got at least partially through the year. The other thing that I would think is interesting with it, and I don't know exactly how this works, so I wouldn't know one way or the other. Teams have already collected their ticket money, right? Most of your money is going to come through season tickets. Now, obviously, there's more that comes with local revenue besides that, but that money is already in the pockets of the NFL teams. So I would think no matter what, that has to count as revenue in 2021. Now, that might knock down your 2022 expectations, but those are already kind of tempered. I think things will be okay no matter what. I don't think that you're going to see this real colossal thing. The bigger issue for me is just I have a hard time projecting where the cap is going to go in the future right now, just because I don't know where we're at with growth on the cap, because I'm just kind of guesstimating how much of a drop there really was. Let's see, is there anything else with this? So this was an email from me, and I do have to write this to somebody. But just the gist of it was just a little bit about like creating a website and creating something. And, I'll write to get some specific questions from them. But, you know, I always get questions like that about how you start off with these things. And, it's not the easiest thing in the world. I mean, it's finding something that you're somewhat passionate about and taking the time, even if it's not necessarily the most financially rewarding in the world, to, you know, write about it, study it, research it, and take the time, I think, to try to interact with people to focus more on it and talk about it. Podcast questions from Twitter. Deadstroke96, when a player with either a full or partial guaranteed base is cut and signs with another team, is there an immediate cap savings or is it reconciled after the season, i.e. guaranteeing team recognizes guarantee is dead money for the year but gets credit in the year-end reconciliation? That's exactly how it works. So if I have a UDFA that has a $100,000 guarantee, I will get charged $100,000 on the cap, even if he signs with another practice squad or my own practice squad that year. You will get a credit for it after the season. The NFL will see that he earned at least $100,000 in practice squad salary, and you'll get your credit for that the following season. So when you see those adjustment columns, that's some of the money that goes into that. Paul says, best guess at a Marshawn Lattimore contract extension. Do you think Marcus Williams gets a new contract? So Lattimore is going to look for a big deal. You know, I don't think that's coming down, you know, anytime soon. But he's going to look for mega money. I don't know. I think he'll hit free agency. I think the fact that they went to the four voids tells you that he's going to go to that. So then you got Marcus Williams, who at 10-6, you know, is he going to benefit from the Jamal Adams numbers? My thought, same as with May, is no. But then you see Harrison Smith get to 16. And I know some people say, well, it's more like a 15, 15-3. That probably pulls the numbers up somewhat. Anyway, I don't think he'll get a new contract this year. I think they'll play this out and then they'll go next year and figure out what they want to do. Jake says, why are linebackers generally less important than corners? If you had to choose, at what position would you like your best player besides quarterback, which is the most valuable and or important? I think linebackers are less important than corners simply because they don't cover the guys that make up the gross amount of yardage that you see come from teams. You know, linebackers are much more specific to situations. They're not going to go out there and they're covering more often than not low impact routes when they're in coverage. Run support is run support. You know, it's not worthless. But, you know, if you have a secondary that can't cover anybody, then your team is going to completely get shredded. If you have the best linebacker in the world in today's NFL and he's paired with just garbage in the secondary, defense is going to get slaughtered. If you have a couple of good corners and you have bad linebackers, you probably still do pretty well defensively. So I think that's really the reason why. I think when you look at who gets targeted, who gets the bulk of the yards, it's just not players linebackers are involved with. I think if I had to choose a best player other than quarterback, I think I would probably go with the edge rusher. It's not because I'm going to say that the pass rush is more valuable than the coverage. You know, I've talked about that before. I don't think it is. But I think coverage is more of a group effort. And I think pass rush can be very much an individualized effort. I think one pass rusher goes a long way, whether it's to help others kind of, I don't know, have more opportunities to rush quarterback because they're getting focused on more. Whether it's because that player alone is just generating a ridiculous amount of pressures on the quarterback, you know, and impacting the play in the secondary. There's consistency year to year. I think I would probably go that position over any other one that I think I would want my second best player to be at the edge, even if it meant, even if I think as a team building concept, I'd want more invested in the secondary. I think there's probably more worth now. It's more expensive right now. There's probably more value in having the one of the top five paid pass rushers and then a bunch of just other dudes than there is in having one of the top five paid cornerbacks and having just a couple dudes in the secondary. I think you're better off with one high-priced pass rusher and just building around a number of decent players in the secondary, I think is probably the better way to go. Connor says, how are injury settlements decided and how do they affect the cap? So typically what happens is a player gets hurt. Let's say he has a high ankle sprain. Let's say a high ankle sprain has a 6-week recovery time. Maybe it's an estimate. So let's say the player gets hurt with, a week left in training camp. So 6 weeks would maybe put you through 4 games. Basically, what they would do is they'd say, okay, he's going to miss 6 weeks. Those 6 weeks would encompass 4 regular season games. So they'll offer a settlement of 4 games. And they might counter and say, well, we think he's going to miss 5, you know, or a full 6, whatever it might be. That's how they decide it. And so what they do is that they pay him the salary that he would have earned if he was on the roster for those games. So, you know, if you're a player with a split salary, lowest total this year, I think it's $415K. If you're going to miss 5 games, they would pay you 5/18 of $415,000. They all count on the cap immediately, whatever that number is. But since the whole salary would count on the cap, teams are oftentimes willing to probably concede on a week if it means getting the guy off the roster. Because otherwise, the 415 counts in full. So if you're a team that's tight against the cap, you want to do that injury settlement. Lucarino says, how is the number for the required minimum spending window calculated? By actual cash paid out? Just wondering if signing bonus payout structure affects minimum spending. The payout structure does not. It's when the signing bonus is agreed to. If you do a contract that has a signing bonus that's paid in, that's agreed to in 2021, even if the majority of the payout happens in 2022, it counts towards 2021 cash for the minimum spending. The minimum spending number is based on whatever the unadjusted salary cap is each year. I think that's what you're asking. That's how they do that. The windows themselves are determined in the CBA. That was negotiated for what those years would be. But the cash that's paid out is dependent on the year that it's promised, not when it's actually paid. Let's see. Evan says, as far as I know, things like unlimited three-week IRs, expanded practice squads, or temporary COVID-related measures to cover last season and this current season. Is this the case? Anyway, the NFL making this a permanent part of the CBA. Yeah, those are all just kind of COVID-related things. I think the expanded practice squads later in the CBA jump out. Maybe not the 16, but they've expanded those. They could end up making these a permanent part of the CBA. Typically, they just end up agreeing to a side letter. And what will happen is I'll make some stupid comment on Twitter, and then I'll get an email from someone from a team and say, well, that used to be the case, but not anymore. and usually that's the way it works. They come up with these little side letter agreements all the time that kind of throw me off because nobody knows about them. You know, unless one of the bigger reporters gets a jump on something because they have someone that's constantly sending them management council documents or something like that, sometimes those things are kind of hard to come by. So you don't know until the situation arises. But I think it would make sense for them to kind of put some of these things in there permanently. All right, last couple questions here. And we'll call this a night since we're already in pretty long. Proud Black Matt says, hi, Jason. What are your thoughts on a rebuilding team signing players in free agency, paying them their bonus, then trading them to other teams for draft picks? Saw some talk on PFF pod that might be what the Texans are doing either by chance or design. So the Texans are clearly doing this by chance. All right. This is definitely not by design. They did not pay Lawson $7 million to trade him to the Jets for a couple of, for a late draft pick. You know, the Seattle Seahawks did not cost themselves a fourth round compensatory pick to gain a fifth by trading someone to the Seahawks. To the Steelers. Most of it is by chance. It's not really by design. I've talked about that before. You know, could teams utilize their cap space if you had an excess amount of cap room to sign a player to a contract and then turn around and trade that player to another team that didn't have the cap room or the budget to do it? And it's kind of a concept that I thought might work, but my thought on this is very different than what's happened in the NFL so far. Like, everyone was so thrilled with the Cleveland Browns, with the Brock, going back to the Brock Osweiler deal. Paying $17 million or whatever Osweiler cost for a second round pick is not a good return on investment. Now, if you just want to say, well, you're going to spend money, you spend whatever money. But when you look at the expected return on the players that you draft, those numbers should line up somewhat with the salaries that you're absorbing for another team. So if you kind of run through the numbers the way that Brad and I did in the drafting stage, you can kind of come up with, okay, what's the expected value of a blind second round pick? What's the expected value of a blind fourth or a fifth round pick? What's the expected value of a first round pick? The expected value on a fourth round pick or a second round pick is not worth $17 million. It's just not. Now you might look at that and say, well, okay, you know, that $17 million, you know, again, whatever it is, you know, works out to about $4 million a year, you know, over a 4-year period, because that's your period on the draft. And then the draft pick plays a certain amount for you. You're still probably not breaking even on that. You're certainly not going to break even on getting a sixth round pick or seventh round pick or whatever they got for paying 7.25 or whatever they ended up paying them. So I think there has to be more alignment between the values. And you can do that. You just have to run through the numbers and calculate those numbers to see what's the logical spot for that to be. And you should get more if you're the team taking on the money, because the other team is desperate to get out of the contract. They're desperate on the short term. You can look at this as like a 4-year investment, because that's the length of time on the rookie contract. you have to calculate the numbers out that way and see what they are. And I probably should look them up, you know, to give you a better number on that. But, you know, to me, that was probably too much. And the Texans, what they did is definitely too much. So I think when you look at them, unless you are looking at this and saying, well, it's making the best of a bad situation, I think that there just needs to be a little bit more thought as to what you would gain from, you know, taking on that salary, you know, that kind of burden. Because the Texans, in this case specifically, I don't think there's a gain that justifies that investment. Let's see, what contracts can the 49ers restructure to get some cap room for the season? I know Jimmy G is the easiest. So, yeah, obviously that's the easiest one. Let's take a look to see. I don't think I had them on a list of teams that need to create cap space, but if they did, let's see, San Francisco. Usually what you do is you just look for teams that, yeah, they might. They're around $2 million. You look for high base salaries. Yeah, you'd probably be looking at Jimmy Ward, Armstead. It would be those two players. If you don't want to touch Garoppolo, one of those two players is who you got to touch. How are injury settlements decided and how they count on the cap? So I think I just touched on that. Don says, how does a practice squad work for veteran contracts? It's basically the same as any other practice squad. You know, they're under contract, but they're still free to negotiate with any other team in the NFL. Their salaries are a little bit higher. I think the base rate for a non-vested player is $165, and I think for a veteran they're $252 this year. I think it's $165.6 and $252 flat, I think. So that's just all it is. It's just they get more money. Humbaba, what is better as a fan? A regular playoff appearances, i.e. Packers or Bucks, or the Bucks style Super Bowl wins? The Super Bowl wins. Regular playoff appearances are fun, but when you don't get anywhere, they're just you just kind of forget about them. You know, do you think the Bengals think of all those years where they were one and done in the playoffs every year? I don't think so. But Bucks fans will always remember winning a Super Bowl. Eagles fans will always remember winning that Super Bowl. You know, so I think by far it's the Super Bowl. If you actually get it, I think you will always say the Super Bowl versus the random playoff appearances here and there where you just don't get anywhere. Now, if you're a team that constantly makes the championship games, you know, where you're second and third round of the playoffs every year, it might be a little different. Probably still the Super Bowl, because eventually it's just incredibly frustrating to probably never win. But just if you're talking general playoff appearances, yeah, definitely the Super Bowl. JP says, the Panthers spent $117 million in active salary this year. The other two, 31, spent an average of $170. Is this gross mismanagement of the roster by the Panthers front office, or do they have something else in mind? Well, some of it, I don't really understand what they're doing, but I think a lot of it is the Panthers are still coming out of a hole. They took over a team that was really, really, really screwed up with the salary cap. They took over a team where they really had to release a whole bunch of veterans, you know, just to kind of get in reasonable shape. Last year, they were very high in dead money in the league. You know, this year, let me see. I think they're probably pretty high again. Yeah, third in the league this year with 45. So they're a team that's really coming out of a giant salary cap hole. So while we can look at the Panthers and we can debate about decisions like Darnold and stuff like that, they're just in a really, really, really deep hole with where their roster was and what it allows them to do right now. So I think that'll change in the future, because historically the Panthers have spent, and I'm sure the guys in charge would like to spend more now to improve the team. But I think in general, you've got not enough guys to extend, and that's where a lot of your big money comes from. But I think the other thing is just that they're still in a pinch from the way they were left before. Carolina just, I just don't understand why they went back to Herney again to kind of allow that to happen. Can a team redo an expiring final year contract to create immediate cap space by adding void years without the player's approval? No, you have to have the player's approval. So yeah, so with Peppers and Ingram, those are the two players mentioned, you would have to negotiate with them a new deal. Usually it's not a problem. It's only a problem if it would impact the tag number for those players, but I don't Definitely for Peppers, it would not. I don't think for Ingram it would either. So I think most of those players would be open to it. You know, the only other thing it can impact is a extension. There's, you can still sign it, but there's little rules that might limit the amount of money that you could get this year if you did something like that. But I don't think that would be an issue that they would think of. Give us your best guess for the top seven teams in order in the AFC. So I think we kind of did that. But if you wanted me to go in order, let's see. If I had to go in order, so I'd go Kansas City 1, Buffalo 2. I think I'd go Baltimore 3, Chargers 4, Jacksonville 5, Bengals 6. Oh, I don't know. Who would I go 7 with? Indy? Probably Indianapolis at 7. I think that probably be my top 7. Finally, Big Gil says, how much you squat? So not the, I don't really, sorry, I thought I just got one other one there, but no, this is just a random question from the dude who usually does ask podcast questions. So squat wise, I usually squat between 275 and 315. I used to squat a lot more though. I go much deeper now, but after leg injuries through the years with knee issues and more the Achilles tear than anything else, it was, like I said, a kind of a weird tear area. It wasn't within the foot itself. It was up high, almost like right off the calf. I have very, very different ranges of motion in my my two legs. And that's actually made it like harder to squat. You know, so what's happened is my right leg is where I tore my Achilles and it healed a bit long. So it's different than my left in that regard. But my left leg also, to make things worse, has a lot of scar tissue left over from lots of ankle sprains that I didn't really take care of that well. You know, probably the high ankle sprain being the worst of them. So I have a more limited range of motion there. So I kind of don't go down the same as I used to, if that makes any sense. And what happens is I kind of end up in these positions where it's almost like you've got this dead left leg, and I push everything with my right side. So typically I kind of stay right within that range to do. I think if I pushed it, I guess maybe I could squat like 350, 360, 365, somewhere in that range, probably for like a rep or two. But I really have to concentrate on probably not going too low, you know, just trying to get right to, I guess, what they would consider like a parallel depth. I go way below that now, you know, but probably concentrate on getting there and really just trying to bounce out of that to do that. I used to do more. I try to get more depth on the squats now than when I was younger, but when I was younger, I could handle more weight, you know, without that feeling of like, all right, I've only got one leg working, or, you know, I can't get much anywhere. But I didn't go, you know, I guess as low as I go now with it. But part of the reason where I go as low as I go now, I think, is just because of just the way my legs are. It's just easier for me that way. So if I can get more flexibility back in my left leg, or somehow magically get my right leg to be back to normal, I could probably get them to function a little better together. But usually that's about the range that I go in for doing just a, you know, a couple reps, usually like five rep sets, is usually what I do when I do squats. I don't usually do much anything with high reps. Maybe once in a while I'll switch up and I'll go much lower in weight. You know, usually no more than like 225, to where I'll try to do like a 8 to 10 reps, for a set. But usually I just don't bother with that. Usually I just try to do less in that regard. But yeah, that's the squats that I do. So if anyone's interested in my squat workout, that's usually the numbers. So I'm going to go back this week. This will be the first week back for me for like 2 weeks. Like, I try to work out when I was on vacation, but the gym facilities are pretty limited. So the best they had there was a Smith machine, and I hate trying to do squats in that. It's like a very unnatural feeling. So I didn't really do much anything there at all. So I'll go back this week. I'll probably be pretty sore. But for that lift in particular, I'll drop off. I'll drop off on that, and I'll drop off on the deadlifts that I do, you know, compared to what I typically do, just because my body hasn't done it for probably 3 weeks now, you know, to like any kind of real kind of physical push. So I'll probably hold off. And even with the deadlifts, I don't really do – deadlifts was something I was never good at. I didn't have, and I still don't have, like, good technique with it. And that's like something that you need good technique with to kind of protect your back. So when I try to go too heavy with that, I always kind of screw my back up. So most of the time I just do the trap bar with that, and that's a lot easier. You can kind of load that thing up. And since you're starting from a higher position and the way you are with that, you can kind of protect yourself a little bit better. So when I was younger, not as much of a worry. Now you get hurt and, you know, just sucks. So yeah. So those are my little lifting stories. So anyway, thanks to everyone for listening. I'll be back next week. And if I'm not back before the regular season begins, everybody have a great time with week one. And we'll catch up with the NFL stuff as we get into the season a little bit more. And I'll get on a schedule that we figure out where we're going to be before the games, you know, so we can throw predictions and stuff out there. Everybody have a great week, and I'll talk to you all again soon.